Today, on Wings, we ask, who controls the internet?
Well, it's very depressive because internet governance is a predominantly white, by the way, but a predominantly male environment. So whoever decides, are usually men. I mean, it's not a surprise if you think that it is a technical sector, but also especially that decision makers are always men, right? So no matter what, also here, we have the same pattern.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
We are all so dependent on the internet these days. But how often do we think about who makes the rules? And how does any of this connect to human rights or gender? I'm Mindy Ran, and I asked my guest today, Stefania Milan, assistant professor of new media and digital culture at the University of Amsterdam, and the founding director of Data J Lab, what is internet governance?
Of course, governance means a number of different things. It means, for example, managing the technical part, so the technical layer, but also means, for example, the physical layer, means the political layer. So a variety of actors are involved in it. A few of others would like to be more involved, and we might not want them, like in terms, for example, of additional controls. And I'm talking, for example, sometimes about states and corporations willing to control the flow of information, what is said, what is exchanged online. So these are also actors involved. But there are also a variety of organizations that are primarily tasked with managing the internet. One of them is probably the most important, at least the one I spend the most time with, is ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. ICANN is tasked with the technical layer of the internet, meaning the names and the numbers. The names are the language that we understand, you know, the address expressed in human language. And then there are the numbers, which is basically the translation into machine language of the language that we understand. These are the IP addresses, So the internet protocol address. If you go over your browser bar and you click somewhere, you're going to see the sequence of numbers and dots that is actually constitutes the IP address. So ICANN manages names and numbers. It makes sure that the names and the numbers are unique identifiers. Let's say if I want to get to your website by typing in a name that then gets translated into a number, we actually get to your website. And we don't get to yours and mine, because otherwise, you know, our fans or clients wouldn't be able to find us. So you need a body in charge of managing this system of unique identifiers. Managing means attributing them and organizing them in practice. There are also a number of technical issues that go around with that. We consider, for example, security, but also, for example, content, even human rights. Although someone will claim that, you know, internet governance, names and numbers are not a matter of human rights. We actually, as civil society activists, believe the contrary. So we're trying to bring human rights into the infrastructure as well. Now, we are also going through a major change these days as we speak. Since 1998, where ICANN was created, it has been regulated, its existence and its mandate has been under a contract with the Department of Commerce of the United States. Now, in March 2015, Department of Commerce has decided to release the control over the technical management of the internet, so release the stewardship role and give it up to the international community. This started a very complex process that is ongoing right now, and we hope to take home in the coming months. But now it's going to be handed over, if everything goes right, to the global multi-stakeholder community.
That sort of surprises me.
ICANN is a very special animal. There's no such organization for any other field that I know of. every decision at ICANN is taken is in a multi-stakeholder manner, which means that, in fact, it was us, the community of internet users and people doing business with the internet, that decided on nearly everything. So it is a corporation, so there is a CEO, there is a board of directors that ultimately take decisions, but there is a very complex, very fascinating, and very transparent process for what concerns decision-making, which makes sure that civil society, the business sector, and governments are all heard in the process. I have also to say that actually the governments are only there with an advisory role. So it is really the community, as they like to call it in ICANN, that decides it. Looking at who is there, you have both NGOs, usually thematic NGOs. You will probably also have some union. I would have to look into the list. There is actually a public list. But you also have, for example, freedom of expression NGOs. You have the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Article 19, organizations of this kind. But you also have a lot of people acting on their individual accord, because this is also part of the internet culture to some extent. One of the main venues within ICANN to get involved as civil society is called the Non-Commercial Stakeholders Group, NCSG. Within that, there is the Non-Commercial User Constituency, I'm part of. And the non-commercial user constituency is the most diverse and the biggest constituency in ICANN, and it is made up of something like 400 plus members. So we're talking about very small numbers. Many of them are organizations. Nonetheless, there's really need and room for engagement of other people. Thing is, it's also not that easy to engage in the field. It's very transparent, very open, but it takes time. It takes resources, it takes, you know, willingness to spend time in a field which is probably less immediate than, let's say, environmental activism or union activism, right? It's very specialized.
And the United States has agreed to hand over control of this? It doesn't seem like it's the sort of place that would agree to hand over control of anything, particularly something like the internet.
This is just conspiracy theory, right? But let me do it a little bit. It was never officially linked, but I think there is a connection. In June 2013, The Guardian, together with Der Spiegel and the New York Times, if I remember correctly, broke the news that a contractor working for the National Security Agency of the United States had revealed, leaked some key information concerning a blanket surveillance program called PRISM. This was the beginning of a number of revelations still actually ongoing that are also connected to some extent with WikiLeaks, but it's not the same story. It was a huge scandal. A lot of people started talking about that. Not only people, but also countries. Countries like Brazil, there were revelations that their president was being spied upon. These countries were very, very vocal against the United States and calling on the United States to justify why to do that and what legitimacy do they have, what mandate, what is happening, right? The president of Brazil, Dilma Rousseff, went all the way to the General Assembly of the United Nations. So it escalates, you know, from, you know, a small case, if you want, a leakage to a major diplomacy problem. It's not clear whether the move of the United States to say we release our control over the technical management of the internet is actually related to that, but one can safely assume that probably there is some connection. So we got to the point in March 2014, the Department of Commerce of the United States, and in particular a branch of it, which is the National Telecommunication and Information Administration, NTIA, announced the release of the control, the stewardship role over the internet. It was something that was already in the air, had been in the air for quite a while, meaning that it was always sort of, you know, expected somehow that this would happen, because of the increased complexity of the internet, because of the, you know, huge stakes and interests from, you know, various parts around the world, so not just the United States. So they said, okay, we are going to get away from this under four conditions. The conditions are that no other country takes over, but the multi-stakeholder community takes over, so that the internet will be managed following a multi-stakeholder model. That the internet will be managed maintaining the security, stability, and resiliency of the network. So in a way, like, we don't give it up so that you guys destroy it. That the new setting will meet the needs and expectation of, you know, people who operate also commercially online, and that the internet is maintained open. So these are the four conditions that the United States Department of Commerce imposed on the people who were starting to think about the transition. The internet is a very complex ecosystem, and there are different players that do different things. Now, I'm very familiar with ICANN because I'm active there, but there are also other organizations that are active.
IG is Internet Governance, and then we've got ICANN, and you said there were other organizations involved. So IGF, which are the Internet Governance Forum, is IGF. IETF is...
Internet Engineering Task Force.
Internet Engineering Task Force. They sound like they should be wearing funny uniforms.
Then there is the ITU, the International Telecommunication Union.
The International Telecommunication Union, the ITU.
And there is...
Now these are getting to be smaller circles here.
So you have registrars and registries.
And are those national, the registrars and the registries?
They are national. They're also thematic.
They're thematic, so example, and national. Right, so .nl or .com or...
This is us, the little users.
Little users, yes.
Did that because it is, so that we know what you're talking about.
Do you have a little diagram like that you can send me that we can put up with the article?
Probably, somewhere.
That would probably be helpful for people.
Yeah, because it is a very complex ecosystem.
Stefania Milan has had as many titles as there are organizations involved. Assistant professor, activist at ICANN, PhD in political science and social sciences, a postdoctoral fellow at the Citizen Lab at University of Toronto, and a participant in the European Union Democracy Observatory on Citizenship. But no matter what the title, all of her work is done through an activist lens, such as explaining what sparked her curiosity as a researcher at the University of Amsterdam conference, Caught in the Act of Protest, Contextualizing Contestation.
I was observing the Occupy protests back then. I was living in Toronto, Canada. So I was also participating in the very tiny encampment. It was a little cold there. So that was the reason for the lack of participation. So what triggered my confusion, let's say, not even my thinking in the beginning, was to see how people were mostly talking to their smartphones as opposed to each other. I also to say that I didn't have a smartphone back then, so I couldn't see the value in it, right? So I started off with these questions. What functions do social media perform in political socialization and within groups? So individuals, at the individual interpersonal level and at the group level. And how do they change collective action? So it's pretty broad questions if you want. And I should also disclose that I am a political scientist. Probably what I do would be called political sociologist or sociology or social movement studies, if we really have to wear a little hat here.
There's been a push from a number of, let's say, activists to have human rights implemented in the various levels of the infrastructure of the internet. So traditionally, when you especially talk about the technical policy making and the logical policy making, people would say, well, this doesn't concern rights, it doesn't concern content, it doesn't really touch on people, this is just the infrastructure. The infrastructure is clean and neutral. We just have to make sure the infrastructure works. Well, we don't actually believe so. We do believe that when setting up, for example, the regulation, as it is happening now, the rules for ICANN to work with the community, and, you know, these are the rules that basically are going to regulate policy making in the future, in the years to come, Well, human rights have also to be in the bylaws, for example, of the organization itself.
Where do human rights come into this process? Because, I mean, if you look at it from a very shallow perspective, as you just said, looking at the infrastructure, it's the way machines connect to machines. So where do human rights actually impact this, and where does this actually impact human rights?
Yeah, I give you a very concrete example. Privacy. Privacy is a human right, and it is very much embedded, I mean, connected with the infrastructure. For example, have you ever heard of the WHOIS database? So WHOIS is this gigantic database.
Who is?
Yeah. It's one word written like WHOIS.
Yeah.
It is a gigantic database that lists all of the contact details, home address, phone numbers, of each person who has ever registered a domain name. For example, StefaniaMilan.net. If you look it up, you're going to find my details. Actually, you're no longer, because I'm using a privacy proxy. But where this is accessible to the entire world, only to, for example, law enforcement, that's a question open for debate, and that can intrude my privacy rights. So traditionally, since the inception of the internet, if you want to register a website, a domain name, you have to give up these details. Now, you're not surprised if I say that law enforcement, especially now in this push for controlling everything and anti-terrorism and all of that, they actually want to have even more information listed there. Now, what information are listed and who get access to this information is very much connected to privacy. So, if somewhere in the bylaws it says, for example, that every piece of policy, every decision that is taken has to have a human rights assessment, then rules might end up looking in a different way, nicer for us, the users, or from the activist point of view.
So what about countries that censor?
Well, if you look at exclusively at the technical policy making of the internet, it's not of concern. The governments only had an advisory role, whereas the community continues discussing things and taking decisions. The governments usually sit a little bit on the side. They are called upon when needed and when there are, for example, issues of public interest. But then, as you can imagine, their governments, they are very, very different. It is somehow a United Nations setting. It's far less representative than the United Nations. There are far less countries. Attending ICANN is time-consuming, is costly, because you have to fly around the world at least 3 times a year. So not all smaller governments, you know, are present or can afford to be there. But then what you have is that, you know, you have a huge contradiction between, let's say, China and, on the other hand, Sweden, when it comes to, you know, what is considered to be a public interest, right? And I'm just picking on two random countries, which I can assume are fairly different in these issues. So these differences, these tensions are played out within the government advisory committee, but they don't usually scale that much up to the board of directors, precisely because, in a way, governments are somehow cornered into an advisory role. They would like to change that. We hope that doesn't happen, but as I mentioned, we are in the process of redefining ICANN as an organization, rewriting the bylaws, working, for example, on the accountability issue of the organization in general, because it has a huge accountability problem, especially if the direct link with the United States is dissolved. You know, this is really a crucial time to see how things are going to develop.
Are there governments that are trying to nab control?
Yeah, but they don't have much of a possibility to have a say there.
There is always a discussion about the gendered aspects, which I always sort of assumed had to do with things like accessibility issues. But I'm beginning to get the feeling that there's a lot more gendered aspects to this. So what are the feminist principles of the internet?
Actually, these are principles that are actually developed in another context by the Association for Progressive Communication. So an NGO that works with grassroots communication. They are an attempt to make sense of how the internet can be used in a way that empowers women, right? Now, if we look at internet governance as such, well, it's very depressive because internet governance is a predominantly white, by the way, but a predominantly male environment. So whoever decides are usually men. I mean, it's not a surprise if you think that it is a technical sector, but also especially that decision makers are always men, right? So no matter what, also here, we have the same pattern. It is not deliberate. It's not because people want to be mean. It's because, again, women are less engaged, less present. They're less, it's less frequent that women are in a position of power. So when you have a multi-stakeholder model that operates in a very nice way with many flaws as well, but operates with whoever is around and whoever is entrusted by his own community, his or her community of reference, to take up that role, you know, it's usually a man again. This is a problem. It's changing. We are, as a civil society, very much concerned about that and always trying to recruit women. But it's a long, long way to go. It's going to be a very long fight, which starts from capacity building, starts from, you know, women empowerment mechanisms, which then have the capacity to escalate all the way up to the governance sector.
Do you really think women would make different decisions?
Frankly, yes. I do believe that women will have the possibility of framing issues in a different way. Maybe this is not particularly visible in internet governance, but if you think, for example, about cybersecurity, which is connected to, in a more or less direct way, with internet governance, at least some aspects of security are also built into the infrastructure. I mean, I like to use this example because cybersecurity is a heavily militarized field. It's mostly army and army guys who make decisions about that. I really often wonder when I am in these settings, what would happen if more women would be at a table? Probably there would be less aggressivity, maybe not, but certainly a slightly different framing. It's a matter of language, it's a matter of vision, it's also a matter of how exchanges are, you know, around the table, for example. So I would love to see more women.
You want women at the top table at places like ICON. You think that it will change the dynamic and the framework of the discussion, particularly at this crucial moment. Now, it seems to me we then get back into what are classically known as gender issues around the digital age, accessibility, empowerment, these sorts of issues.
Yes, unfortunately. In this sense, it would be nice if it was different. But basically, the internet reproduced and probably brings even to the next level, because it's a very technical field, all the divide that you already see existing in other fields of human activity. Now, how do you counteract these dynamics? How do you actually bring more women to the table? Well, you know, I don't think that having a Barbie with the nerdy glasses and with the computer, that's actually what we need. We need good role models. We don't need, you know, to make fun of stereotypes. It's a matter of education. It's a matter of, you know, the imprint that families themselves give to girls when they tell them play with a doll instead of play with a video game. Instead, the family, the school, the society restricts very often our option and kind of squeezes it into certain professions as opposed to others. Now, one way of learning, let's say, you know, for women that are, you know, too late to go back to school and change a topic of study or, you know, change career, is playing with technology. It's extremely empowering. And programming is actually something that you don't have to be super smart. You don't have to be super, super talented, not a super expert. There are a number of platforms, a number of kits, and a number of programs that allow you to learn to code. I really like this kind of practical approach to technology, which entails soldering transistors to a motherboard, building your own microprocessor, and then being able to, you know, make a light blink. I still remember the first time I did it. I went through a workshop in which I learned in a couple of hours to solder a little transistor to a motherboard following a little, you know, a drawing. Anyone can do that. From that, connect the battery, and then you have a blinking light. Isn't that great? That's something that everyone can do, and I would encourage everyone to do it because it is fun and it is empowering. But it's also important, to create an environment that is nurturing. What do I mean? There's a lot of paternalistic attitude in this field. The kind of, you know, the guy patting on your shoulder and saying, oh yeah, but you don't get this, right? There was recently a debate, a discussion on a mailing list that started off because a guy claimed that women, they're not good hackers because they don't have a mind that is programmed to program. Like if it was a genetic issue, right? Rather than education and cultural issue. This is 2015, right? When this started, not millions of years ago. So even in the activist circles, there are these problems. So what do we need to create an environment that encourages us to take action and not feel, you know, dumb? Well, probably women-only spaces are a way to go. And it somehow hurts me to advocate for that. But I do believe in women-only spaces as a kind of transitional space. So I'm not saying that women have to be separate from the others, but I'm saying let's try to create a nurturing environment where we women meet and where we women learn mutually, teach each other and learn together. It can include men as well, right? But it has to operate on our own rules. There's a friend of mine who's also very, very active in ICANN. She's a lawyer, Kathy Kleiman, from the US. As part of her, you know, activism, her passion, she noticed when she was much younger than now that there was a picture of one of the first computers. In this picture, that was, you know, my computer was gigantic, like as big as a room, roughly. And there were two men, or a limited number of men, and there were several women. Yet, the caption and the picture only mentioned the name of the man and completely ignored the women that were moving in the background. And so, since she came across that picture, she kept wondering, what happened with these women? Why did women disappear from the story of this first computer? And then it turned out, and she went out, there's a documentary, a very beautiful documentary on this story. She went out to try to interview these women. And then it turned out that actually the history, it's not a funding that is, you know, an exclusive funding. It's actually a well-known story. The computers were women. There were no machine. So the terminology computer was the person that was inputting data into the machine. And because it was a sort of low-ranking jobs, those were women. Women contributed big time, not only from the low-ranking perspective, but also there were amazing women that participated in actually making advances and discoveries that led to the computer and, you know, everything that we know as computer now. Yet, for the large majority, they disappear from the history.
My thanks to my guest today, Stefania Milan, assistant professor of New Media and Digital Culture at the University of Amsterdam, and the founding director of Data J Lab. I'm Mindy Rann for the Women's International News Gathering Service.
To hear WINGS programs again, email wings@wings.org or visit our page at facebook.com/wingsradio. WINGS thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the new book, The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The WINGS sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.